Several years ago, I was somewhere in the middle of the state of Indiana in a small little amusement park with my family on vacation, and we were going to sit down the midday point and have lunch. And so I walked towards the restroom with my son, then 5 years old, to perform the Tilat Yadayim in the bathroom. And the scene of a father and son sporting a yarmulke and tzitzis was obscure enough in this little town, whose name eludes me at the moment, but no feeling of awkwardness and being out of place could have prepared me for what I saw next. We walked into the bathroom, and there was a giant man sitting on a chair next to his son. The man had a long biker's beard, a silver-colored tooth. He wore a sinister grin on his face. At that moment, I noticed it. A giant swastika tattooed on his left leg, and another smaller one for good measure on his right leg. And I was stunned, to say the least. A myriad of thoughts raced through my head. In this day and age, how could someone still wear a symbol like that? I was pained. I was frightened. I was indignant. At the same time, I became aware that my son was sitting next to me, and I slowly shifted in front of him, attempting to shield his holy little eyes from the appalling and gruesome symbol which stood right in our line of vision. And now, perhaps it wasn't as bad as it had seemed. He was already around 45, 50 years old. He could have been drunk. 19-year-old at the time, one night, stumbled into a tattoo parlor, and maybe later he regretted what he had done. A tattoo is so permanent. Maybe he did tshuva. But then again, the tattoos on the arms of a fleeting number of men and women who survived the Holocaust were also permanent. Maybe I supposed having a child has softened him. And maybe he's become more educated. And maybe he's a stupid redneck who never met a Jew in his life and never read a history book or seen the wonderful contributions that Jews have made throughout history and the world. And perhaps he believed that I belonged in a camp. Maybe I'm subhuman and so is my son. And all of this was very unclear to me at the moment. And so I stared down at the man and he stared at me. Our eyes were locked in, they met, as if the first person to break the mold would lose the showdown. And I was secretly frightened for my life. And I was aware of the fact that he had a child with him, and that I had one with me. And I was confident that because of this fact, and that we were in public, we were safe by the rules of human nature. But then I thought of the million children who weren't safe from the clutches of evil, even though they were children and innocent, and the public looked upon them, and then they looked the other way at all the atrocities of the time. And wasn't it true that the SS soldiers themselves had children of their own? At least some of them did. Did that make them any more sensitive and humane? The innocence of small German children was not something to be taken for granted, nor was I going to assume innocence of this young boy. And yet I walked by him and his father, and we washed our hands in the sink in the ritual fashion, and we approached the exit door on the opposite side of the restroom, so as to avoid seeing him again. But to my surprise, and a little bit my fear, he followed us to the further door. And he came within a few inches of us, and I instinctively reached for the door handle. I pulled it open, and I found myself contemplating one last simple yet practical question. Do I open the door for this son of a gun? If I hadn't seen his tattoo, if he was anyone else in the world, even wearing a PLO headdress, I probably would have opened the door. But this callous and evil man, I thought to myself, he deserves to have the door slammed in his face. And I looked down to his son, and then I glanced back at mine, and then I opened the door. And without a word, I signaled for him and his son to walk on through. He glanced back at my eyes one last time and said through gritted teeth, "Thank you." We read on the Mondays and Thursdays the Tachanun prayer, which has the following painful line: Habet mishamayim ure ki hainu laag vakeles bagoyim. Gaze upon us from heaven and see that we've become rejected and disgraced ones of the world. Nechshavnu katzon latevach yuval laharog ulaabed ulamaka ulacherpa. thought upon as sheep marching to their slaughter. The Rav pointed out, as he explained the kinos of Tisha B'Av, that the greatest tragedy of Charban Bayis was that we became the refuse and the garbage of the world. We became the discarded ones. The world inexplicably hates us. It's a mystery, but they do. There's no rational explanation for this hate. They look at us, and we're nothing but filth in their eyes. We're greedy, we're selfish, we're whiny, we're ugly. And the Gentile pretends sometimes to care, and he pretends to be our ally when it's convenient. But the blink of an eye, we've become time and time again the scapegoat. It's not true. You say, life has never been as good as it is now. True. But in every generation, and now increasingly more each day, we find creeping up the ugly head, rearing its head of anti-Semitism, hatred, and sometimes in more innocuous fashions, in a quieter voice, which seeks to delegitimize us through our homeland and our ethics. So how do we respond to this anti-Semitism? How do we answer when the world attacks us? What's the mode of conduct for the 3 weeks Jew who is acutely aware of the antipathy that the world has traditionally held for the Jew? Our parsha tells us, following the events of Balak, Bilam, the Midianim, after all of this, after the aftermath of the mass and widespread idolatry and promiscuity in the time of the Midianim, we receive the instructions as to what our response ought to be. Nikom nikmat b'nei Yisrael me'eta Midianim achar te'asef alamecha. God says, go and avenge the crime committed against your people. The B'nai Yisrael were wildly successful in battle. They wiped out the enemy as charged. And yet Moshe becomes infuriated with the officers when they brought home the women as captives. He rebukes them. Vayitzof Moshe al pekudei achayel sarei alafim v'sarei meot habaim mitzvah melchama. Vayomer lehem Moshe hachiyitem kol nekeva. You've allowed the women to live. Hein heina hayu livnei Yisrael bidvar bilam. They're the ones who caused this. They're the ones who are responsible for the harsh decree which afflicted you. But the moment after the harsh decree, after the merciless approach, we are told then to show the women and children of Midian that there is a relenting of sorts which takes place, that we're not so harsh. Any boys who are untainted, you may let them live. Let them dwell outside for 7 days. Kol horeg nefesh. Anyone who kills, he should live outside the machane for 7 days. Because after killing, you become defiled and you have to stay outside. The Torah goes on to tell us, not only are you allowed to save some of the women, children, but you can marry them. You could sanctify their kelim, their vessels. The Darchei Noam, the Rebbe of Slonim, talks about how from the darkest and most depraved enemy of the world emerges the potential for marriage, for kiddushin, for sanctity. And we learn from here the laws of Hechsher Kelim, of taking a vessel which was impure and making it holy. The notion that we believe that in every darkness, from every piece of impurity, there is a recoverable remnant of kiddusha. And the Meshiloach points out that it's not by chance that Moshe is buried mul beis pa'or, counterbalancing the impurity of Midian, buried right next to one of our worst enemies, that Moshe Rabbeinu is there to sanctify that place. How unfair is it to Moshe? Not only can he not be buried in Israel, his homeland, his dream, but he has to be in the same cemetery as Zimri and Cozbi, as Bilam and Balak? And the answer is yes, that in the face of evil, the holiness of Moshe Rabbeinu emerges and must emerge. In the darkest hour, in the light of the Jew, has to become a beacon for the world. Specifically when the world paints us in a negative light. Specifically when they point the finger at us and castigate us and throw us away with the trash. That's when we shine. We don't lose our resolve at that moment. We never lose sight of what makes us holy. And we never forget why God placed us on this earth in the first place. to sanctify the name of heaven? How do we respond to criticism, to anti-Semitism? What do we do in the face of those who seek to destroy us? Yes, there are times in which vengeance is appropriate. There are times in which justice is the correct modality and should always be achieved. But above all, we also never lose our dignity. We never forget that the holiness that the Jewish people who have been blessed with that holiness and the potential that we have for Kiddush Hashem, for sanctifying the name of God. Yes, Hainu Lag V'Kelis Pagoyim, all the time we are the disgrace and the refuse of the world, but that they hate us and that we defend ourselves is not a chiddush. It's nothing new. What is new is that we maintain our place as the human manifestations of God's glory in the world, B'Tzelem Elokim Tavniso. And so we say in Tachanun, Kanu Lag V'Kelis Pagoyim, despite the pain described in that sentence, we close the sentiment with a word of comfort. U'v'chol zos shimcha lo shachachnu. Despite what they did to us, we don't forget your name, God. We hold our heads high. Na'al tishkachinu. And in schus of that, do not forget us. They wear symbols of hate and death, and we open the door. Because in that moment, his son will see the Shekhinah in a room without a mezuzah, in the middle of nowhere, Indiana, during his brief and only encounter with a Jew. And maybe neither of them, not the father or the son, will be affected and changed by that encounter. But maybe, just maybe, my son, who has no idea what that tattoo meant because he was only 5 years old, will see that Jews open doors for other people. The Jews perform acts of kindness, even when it seems you get nothing in return. And the Churban Bayis may have stripped us of our prestige and our esteem, but through kind acts, and through mitzvos, and through dignity, we restore that gleaming crown to its rightful owner, and the light to its original luster. I saw a story a while ago of Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky Zatzal recounted that when he was a rabbi in Lithuania before World War II, he was asked a question by a resident of his community. The man purchased stamps from the local post office and received more stamps than he had paid for. And for such a poor man, the extra stamps were no small matter. But nonetheless, Rav Kamenetsky suspected that perhaps the clerk was testing the rabbi. Indeed, the suspicion was confirmed a short time later when the clerk gave him too much change in return. The rabbi returned the extra money, and many years after the Nazis came and destroyed the community, the rabbi heard that this clerk had saved many Jews, and he testified that he had tested everybody to assess their honesty. The only trustworthy people he had met at that time were the Jewish people. It doesn't matter what's going on in the world. It doesn't matter what we must do, even when it's the unthinkable, even when it's meeting out justice of our own. We still have to walk out of that room with our head held up high.